Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. This is the northern panel of the Nevada Supreme Court appearing here in Clark County, since we have Clark County cases. So, Ms. Dustin, Mr. Stanton, you're very lucky. You didn't have to come up to Carson City today. We came down, and hope it's a convenience to both of you for being able to do this. It saves money for the parties and for the state here.
Very much for me, Your Honor, because I'm in trial one floor below. Okay, no.
All right. This is case number 54497, Adrian McKnight versus State. Ms. Dustin, for the appellant, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Dustin, when you come up, I can just say the three of us have met and gone through all the issues here in the case, and we'd really like to focus on this one issue about the preclusion of you being able to cross-examine and about some other defendant may have been responsible, or a third party may have been responsible for this crime, and the restriction that Judge Mosley put on you that was reversed by Judge Brennan, whether that cured it or didn't with Judge Brennan, what impact did that have on your trial strategy, and whether that you properly objected to that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think probably just to kind of hit in the dynamic of where we were at is when we set foot at trial, we had the lower court's ruling saying, Mr. McKnight, you are not allowed to essentially point the finger at Mr. Smith to note that Mr. Smith was there in any way. And the court did that because we had been bringing severance issues. There were some Bruton issues. Some of the Bruton problems were alleviated by when Ronnie Gibson, the third co-defendant in the case, did plead and agree to testify. But the lower court made this unique ruling saying that Mr. McKnight, should he testify or at any point in the trial, that he could not essentially make any allegation that Mr. Smith was present, and that's how the court felt that it was going to rectify any of the Bruton issues that we were claiming on severance.
Now, at what point did you, on behalf of Mr. McKnight, first assert that violated Mr. McKnight's due process rights to present his trial as distinguished from the argument in the context of severance?
Well, our dilemma was that we kind of got that ruling almost on the eve of trial because we had many times that we had been before the court regarding a variety of motions. And so prior to calendar call, Judge Mosley had made his final rulings, had said, Judge Brennan, I have Judge Brennan coming in to hear the case. I don't want any change. We didn't initially anticipate a huge problem until we crafted our opening statements to conform with the court's ruling. And I know Mr. Stanton and the state crafted their opening statements in accordance with the rulings. However, what started happening, which alerted us to the problem, was when Mr. Smith's counsel started their opening statements, immediately it's, you know, a turn to the defendant's table, literally a finger point to Mr. McKnight, and that's where we start having the infringement upon Mr. McKnight's rights, because now Mr. Smith has no limitation on him, and his counsel took full advantage of it, that pointing the finger, this is who it was, because when we started off on this case, our initial statements that we were getting from Ms. Nieva was that there were two assailants that were there that robbed her. Now, as investigation went on, Ms. Nieva, through her testimony to the grand jury, said it wasn't two, it was actually three, it was dark, she was very scared. But one of the theories that I think Mr. Smith's counsel was trying to advance is she's always said, you know, right at the start, on the night that this happened, two assailants. We're going to hear from Ronnie Gibson, who's going to say he's there, so there's only going to be one other person, and it's the turn and the point at Mr. McKnight.
What did you do then when that happened?
Well, that's when we started objecting and started having some issues with what started going on, and we started raising concerns to Judge Brennan. What happened next was...
At what point did you first raise that concern to Judge Brennan? The problem I'm having is the session with Judge Mosley was not attended by the state, as I understand it.
Exactly.
And then Mosley comes and puts this on the record. There's no objection on the record at that point other than to the loss of your motion to sever.
Correct.
Then you get into trial and you get through opening statements, and it appears that Mr. Smith in the vernacular is throwing Mr. McKnight under the bus.
That's correct.
And at what point, I'm just trying to understand, at what point in the record did you say to Judge Brennan, you know, this ruling might have been okay, but it is not working out, and it's infringing Mr. McKnight's right to put on his case?
Your Honor, when we really started raising that and making formal additional motions to sever was after opening statements and after Ms. LaBelle's testimony. We had Ms. LaBelle come. The state offered her as almost one of the first witnesses. And that's where, you know, opening statement, as Judge Brennan kept saying repetitively, opening statement is not evidence, it's a roadmap. However, when Mr. Smith's counsel started with Ms. LaBelle, really, I mean, moving behind Mr. McKnight, pointing to him, doing all those things, that's when we launched another oral motion to sever, saying, we're too far afield now. We've had the problem at opening, which we weren't really happy with, but now it's starting to be exacerbated. And that's in the record right around page 752 is when we start launching another motion to sever. And that's where even Ms. Stanton for the state started launching his concerns, saying, you know, Mr. Smith's counsel is kind of going overboard here, because we're stepping into the line where Mr. McKnight's rights are being infringed upon. Now, this continued on, and then you can see at pages 1425 to 1426 that, again, we're starting to say we're too far. We're too far along. Judge Brennan is at this point deciding, well, I'm not going to sever you, but now I'm going to lift that hold on you. But we're multiple witnesses into the case at this particular juncture. We've got the opening statement, the cat's out of the bag, and now we're forced to shift our strategy mid-trial, where all along we've had point the finger, point the finger, point the finger at Mr. McKnight, and we've kind of been like, okay, I mean, as much as the state wants to say this is finger pointing both directions up by co-defendants, that kind of implies that it's a dual direction. One co-defendant saying, not me, him. The other co-defendant saying, not me, him. Well, here that's not what we have. Here what we have is Mr. Smith's counsel going, this is the person, this is the person, this is the person. Two people, two people, two people. This is him. Gibson, McKnight, Gibson, McKnight. And so we start off and we're going along through witnesses. Ms. LaBelle talks about two people. It's point, 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 point. Mid-trial, here's Judge Brennan saying, okay, well, I'm going to lift that ruling, I'm going to modify it, and now you're free to point your finger at Mr. Smith. But how many witnesses are we in? How far are we in?
Can you tell us, and we understand that, the sequencing, but how did that prejudice you as far as how you would have questioned these witnesses differently if that had been lifted, let's say, at the beginning of the trial?
Well, one of the issues that we had with the case that we were advancing in a dual direction was Ms. Nieva's statement. Ms. Nieva said initially on the night that this happened that there were two assailants, and the person that was assailing her husband was a light-skinned, smaller black male, which did fit the description of Mr. Gibson, and that there was another person who was assailing her. We advanced alternative theories that Mr. McKnight had no idea that Mr. Gibson was going to take things so far, had nothing to do with Mr. Nieva, was not dealing with him, took Ms. Nieva's purse, ran to the car, and that was the end of things. Then when the state was advancing, hey, there's three people there, we were still with that position, but we were never able to say, here's the person who came up with the plot, here's the person who was there at the LaBelle robbery. As much as we're saying it's not us, we now have Mr. Smith's counsel pointing the finger at Mr. McKnight through the whole thing. Ms. LaBelle basically said she was shown a six-pack, Mr. McKnight's not in it. there's a general description, it's dark at night, I can't see a face, it's a black male. But aside from when Mr. Gibson gets up on the stand and says it's Mr. McKnight, at this point, you know, all I have is Mr. Smith pointing the finger, not us, it's this guy here, and we can't refute that. So that's where the lines start shifting, that Mr. Smith is enjoying the unfettered right, and Mr. McKnight is starting to be completely deprived of having this unprejudiced and fundamentally fair trial, because we're behind the eight ball from ground zero, and now we're having to shift gears mid-trial to a whole nother theory, which the jury is going to be like, well, wait a minute. You did cross-examine on these people, and you never said Mr. Smith's there, so now you're going to start pushing that Mr. Smith's there. We've got two incidents, you know, then here goes clearly.
Did you ask to recall any of the witnesses that had previously testified to maybe going to new areas of cross-examination?
We actually did not. It was unfortunately a fairly lengthy trial, and we were stuck with some time limitations with three co-defendants initially, and we were blocked off a certain amount of time, so we weren't asking to recall witnesses. We advanced the position to Judge Brennan, listen, we're too far afield, we can't shift gears, we're going to have a problem, we've got impingement on our cross-examination. The remedy that was suggested was, listen, you've got a jury seated, move along with Smith, sever us out now, and we can either piggyback, we can shift, and it's going to protect Mr. McKnight's rights at this particular point. They could have still carried on with Mr. Smith, which would have explored, potentially a negotiation for Mr. McKnight, or we start trial again with him, which still would have been a little faster, because then instead of multiple defense attorneys, now you're just down to one, and things can move a little faster. But I think that's where our dilemma was, is you're kind of having to change your theory of defense midstream, where it's a little hard to refute the finger pointing right from the get-go and the whole time along, and then suddenly you're trying to change gears to say, oh, hey, by the way, here's the third person. And now it looks almost retaliatory to the jury.
Thank you.
You want to save some time? You've got about 3 minutes and 50 seconds left.
Yes, please. I would reserve the balance of my time.
Sam, on behalf of the state.
Justice Gibbons, to answer your last question to counsel, no, they didn't ask to recall him. There was no time constraints as far as anybody asking the court to recall witnesses, to reopen cases. There was the record does not indicate that any time counsel was prohibited in doing anything in this particular case. And Justice Pickering, I think you hit the nail on the head that I think one of the most critical aspects of your analysis on this issue that you've highlighted begins on page 744 of the record, where indeed the court held this hearing in camera about the defense. And let me just add a little context to that hearing that led up to that. The defense had moved to sever, and one of the bases they asked for severance, as they normally do, is the Bruton issue. And I stood up to the court and in detail outlined to the court and to counsel how we were going to redact the statements of the various defendants at trial. Obviously, Mr. Gibson testified, so that wasn't an issue, but certainly Mr. McKnight's testimony, where he had given significant evidence about his own involvement in the two events. One was the LaBelle robbery that was the precursor to the Nieva robbery and murder. And thus, in that context, after the redaction and Bruton issue was resolved, my argument was, and the issue before the court was, what is the defenses of the defense counsel at trial to whether or not you could even make the decision that they were mutually exclusive? And then the second prong that this court has articulated, the articulation of a specific denial of a trial right. And we never got to that point in a finding because defense counsel requested that, hey, we'll tell you what our defenses is so you can formulate your ruling. And they go back in, and I wasn't privy to what was said. The record isn't. You're not. But what is clear on page 744 was both defense counsel, to include Ms. Dustin on behalf of Mr. McKnight, came out and made no objection to the court's ruling. Now, counsel argues to you this morning that once the trial began, somehow they got far afield from what, I guess, presumably was argued in chambers. I don't know. But I would take two issues with the characterization of this as finger-pointing. Number one is what Mr. Smith's lawyers did was they argued the evidence. And ironically, the evidence was from the victims, the surviving victims of both robberies, Ms. LaBelle earlier in the evening and Ms. Nieva while her husband was being murdered. They both testified that the people that they saw were two. And Ms. LaBelle and Mr. Gibson testified that there were two people that went, if I will, hands-on to her during the robbery. And Mr. Gibson indicated, being the youngest of the two and the smallest, was the getaway driver sitting in the car. So it didn't preclude in her testimony that there were three people present. And all the statements, including Mr. McKnight's statement to the police, had indicated that, although he denied involvement in the LaBelle robbery, that there were three people present and involved in the Nieva murder and robbery. And so it's no surprise to anybody that in mid-trial that there's now finger-pointing, and I don't think characterizing it as finger-pointing is appropriate. What Mr. Smith's counsel did was highlight to the jury that the evidence from the victims indicated two people were present, and then they highlighted what the victims could recall about the physical descriptions of people that were doing the attacking. Some of that was consistent with Mr. Gibson, some of it was consistent to Mr. Smith, and also Mr. McKnight. The most compelling evidence, and it led to part of this appeal of the use of the photograph in my opening, was Mr. McKnight was a very large, powerful man. And the evidence was that Angel Nieva was picked up and literally turned on his head and slammed on the pavement, causing his death when he and his wife were being robbed. The physical description and appearance of both Mr. Smith and Mr. Gibson was significantly different from Mr. McKnight as far as who physically could have accomplished that task. So once again, the argument that was proposed by counsel, I would characterize not as finger point, because no one in this trial said, that's this person that did it. It was a highlight to the jury of what the evidence was that there were two attackers, and then by inference, both Mr. McKnight and Mr. Smith were free to argue at closing, as they did, hey, it wasn't my client at this particular event. Now, Mr. McKnight was constrained in making the argument in the Nieva murder and robbery that he wasn't there, because his statement indicated that he was. His statement was that he was involved in going hands-on with Mrs. Nieva, and that he did come in contact with her, physical contact, and he robbed her. But he had nothing to do with Mr. Nieva. That was his statement. That was what is admitted to this jury. Now,
could you comment for me? I'm a bit puzzled by McKnight's assertion that you agreed that the McKnight defense was prejudiced by the Mosley ruling. Yeah, and I've read the references at 752 and 753 of the record, and I don't read them that way, but I don't know if I'm missing something. Did you make that concession or didn't
absolutely
you?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, and that was one of my notes to say that somehow the state was in agreement that he was, that is, Mr. McKnight's rights were being infringed was absolutely not what the state was articulating, merely that Mr. Smith's counsel was misstating the law and going outside of what was required, but in no way, shape, or form did I ever articulate that Mr. Smith was somehow, or Mr. McKnight was somehow prejudiced by the conduct of where this trial was going.
But you agreed with the ruling that the prohibition should be lifted.
I did, Your Honor, and when I read the briefs, I kind of forgot that I wasn't privy to the in-chambers conference that occurred that led to Judge Mosley's ruling. I just, as a matter of a trial lawyer, looking at it saying, I don't know how that ruling can exist as a matter of law. Because if a defendant is taken to stand, not only should Mr. McKnight be able to ask the questions, but I certainly want to ask him the questions on cross-examination is, well, okay, you said you did this. Who were you with? What did they do? And that's what was the frustration to the state was, is not to, did I think, or, because part of what I think the state's obligation to is to protect the record and protect the court's ruling as well as defense counsel's strategy decision, because ultimately we stand before you defending both.
Yeah, let's say we find that that is, or we don't find, but we rule that the Mosley ruling should not have been made, that it was an unfair imposition on Mr. McKnight. Would you, can you make your argument for whether that was harmful or harmless error?
I would, Your Honor, and I would think that the record, especially in light of the points that this court has made to Ms. Dustin, highlights that. Number one is, there is no expression then or now of a specific line of inquiry that would have changed or that she would have sought to do had she recalled any witnesses. Not one citation, not one hypothetical, not one example presented to this court. And I would submit.
What about LaBelle? She said the cross-examination of LaBelle would have been different.
Well, I don't, in what regard? I mean, to say that it would have been different is one thing, but to say, okay, this is the question that I would have asked her. I mean, all what Ms. LaBelle could testify to is what she did, the description of what she had of her attackers. And it literally was, as I approached my apartment, there was a black male sitting on a electrical box. As I walked past, he grabs my purse. I struggle. He jumps off the curb. He falls. Next thing I know, I'm grabbed from behind. I look down, and all that she can describe is the size and the color of the skin she sees on the arm wrapped around her. I don't know what further examination you could do of her that would change if the ruling had changed. I can't think of a hypothetical question, and I think that's part of what we fail to see both in oral argument as well as in the written brief, saying, okay, if the ruling is defective, what would have the examination been different? And I think that's the reason why they didn't recall any of the witnesses, because it couldn't have been any different.
What about opening? I mean, they're told one set of rules apply on opening, so they get up and do their opening, and then all of a sudden the ground rules for the game change favorably to them, but after they've already had their first presentation to the jury. What do you do with that argument?
Well, I don't think that it would have changed their argument, number one, because I hear no argument today, an example of how it would change, but more importantly, the evidence suggested and the defense, the natural defense that existed in both these events, was that two people were involved and only two people. They were never denied that opportunity. So to say that somehow that ruling would have opened it the door further for them, I don't see how reasonably one can look at those facts. And looking at the opening argument that they did, remember Mr. McKnight was constrained. Counsel for Mr. McKnight was constrained that they had to admit, because his statement was coming in, that he was involved in the second robbery. They did argue in opening and they did argue in closing that there was insufficient evidence to convict Mr. McKnight regarding the LaBelle robbery. That is, once again, that the victim could only testify that two people were present. And the state had no other independent evidence about that, at least forensically, that would conclusively tie it. There was some forensics regarding the stolen vehicle, some fingerprints, and so forth, but that could have been attributed to the Nieva robbery later on. Literally, the only evidence that existed was Ms. LaBelle's testimony, because she survived the attack. She could only describe two distinct individuals that attacked her. That was available at any time, regardless of Judge Mosley's rule.
Are you saying we should reverse the LaBelle robbery?
No. What I'm saying, Judge, is it wouldn't have made any difference had the ruling been one way or another that precluded them from arguing that there was insufficient evidence to convict Mr. McKnight as to the LaBelle robbery. There was only that evidence to suggest two people. And that the ruling of Judge Mosley, should this court determine that it was an error, wouldn't have changed the fabric of the counsel's ability to make that argument at any time during the trial. Okay.
Mr. Stanton, do you recall if that standard jury instruction was given that opening statements and closing arguments of counsel is not evidence and should not be considered as such?
It was, Judge. It was given in the charge of the jury at the end. It was part of the standard package. It was not given contemporaneous with any of the arguments because no request was made. But I think it's very important that highlighting that is, as this court has indicated to Ms. Dustin, that indeed certainly evidence of a prejudice that would befall their counsel in the trial would have opened the door to them asking to open their case, to recall witnesses, to ask the questions. But simply, I challenge the record and the counsel in arguing both in a brief and an oral argument to say what would have changed had you had the opportunity to recall any of these witnesses. And it wouldn't have, especially in light of their predicament of the Nieva and his statements. You certainly couldn't have changed it as far as it goes to that particular, those particular counts. And I would submit that that was the only witness that would have made any difference in the presentation of the case. And obviously the decision for Mr. McKnight to testify and to answer those questions was the same dynamic. And I certainly thought there was sufficient time that when the judge Brennan changed the ruling for them to make an informed, complete, and voluntary decision as to whether Mr. McKnight should testify.
What do you do with their, I'm switching fields here, but what do you do with their rule of completeness argument with respect to the partial admission of Mr. McKnight's statement and their wanting the balance to come in?
Well, I think what I believe is the rule regarding the rule of completeness is that Bruton trumps the rule of completeness, that that right supersedes it when you have a collision of rights. That is case law, I think, has addressed that numerous times, both in the state and the federal system, that the compelling right of
Smith
is what drives the case, and that as much as you may want some other aspects, you still have relief, should you so desire, and that's to testify, but that your statement, unsworn, given to law enforcement officers, is subject to the trumping card that is the rule of Bruton.
And you don't think that analysis should be affected in any way by him having headed into this trial muzzled as to Smith?
No, because, I mean, certainly that's interesting. I would appreciate, Justice Pickering, that they had the choice of saying, look, we might be able to get what we need in if Smith were to testify, or we could testify and get around it. But that is still an option that they had plenty of time to strategically address.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Ms. Destin. Rebuttal.
With all due deference to Mr. Stanton, it's kind of interesting that today he claims that this is not finger pointing, because even on that day, every day that we were in court and bringing this issue up, that's exactly what Mr. Stanton was calling it. And I'll reference you to page 753, where Mr. Stanton said, Judge, there's no need to sever this. This is nothing but finger pointing. It's referenced multiple times in the opposition's to our arguments about how there was error for the court to not severance it, because the state repetitively calls it finger-pointing, but today it's not. And the reason being is because that's what our problem is. As much as they wanted to characterize it as finger-pointing, finger-pointing suggests it's both directions, and as Justice Pickering had pointed out, Mr. McKnight was muzzled right at the start. I mean, how much more can you tell a defendant, and how can you strategically do something when you're told, even if you get up on the stand, you still can't say, Mr. Smith was there, here was his role, here's what he did, here's what I know that he did. You're told from the get-go, you can't even say that. So as much as we have potentially a Bruton issue, the Bruton issue only comes about when the detective testifies. But here, Mr. McKnight was told, you get up on the stand, you can't even say that. You can say, oh, there's another person. I mean, how genuine is that going to look? And that's even what Mr. Stanton pointed out, was here's where his rights are being infringed, because if Mr. McKnight gets on the stand, what jury's going to believe him when everybody else is potentially claiming that Mr. Smith was there, but yet Mr. McKnight can't even say that it's Mr. Smith? I mean, that's where the state, Mr. Stanton even noted, that's where the rights had an issue.
But the prohibition was lifted in time for him to testify. So what we need to know is prejudice.
Of course, Your Honor. And what I think a lot of Mr. Stanton points out is essentially, what would I have done differently? Well, here's a few things. The LaBelle, I mean, you have to look at the record. I mean, Mr. MacArthur, they were pointing out, Mr. Bloomfield, they were pointing out height differences. They were having their defendant stand up. They were having them do a lot of things to just keep showing you can't give a face description, you can't do anything, but yet we can't even suggest that it's Mr. Smith. We can't hint that it's Mr. Smith or anything, whereas that's where their position is going. Well, Mr. Smith, you know, he's taller, he's shorter, you know, it can't happen, but look at Mr. McKnight. And that's where they start going, where we're not allowed to pull out the distinctions, we're not allowed to point out to say, hey, sorry, just so you know, you never saw Mr. McKnight there, but the person that you did see was Mr. Smith. Because we had some distinctions that were going on there that we were fettered on being able to even go those directions. That's where it's different. It's different when I'm able to stand at opening statement to say, here's what happened that night. Mr. McKnight grabs the bag, runs back to the car, but here's the person who picked out this couple, who sat in the front seat of the car and selected. Here's Ronnie Gibson pointing, and he touches the window as to those are the people we want to go get. These are the people sitting in the front of the car. It's Mr. McKnight who's just along for the ride. We could never even go that direction at opening statement because we couldn't use Smith's name.
Thank you very much to both of you. Thank you for your argument and your briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.
Thank you.